This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Since this March, advocates, activists, lawmakers, service providers, they've all been working together to end chronic homelessness in Connecticut. This seems like an almost impossible goal, but as you've been hearing on our program over the last few months, the state is making progress. We've been talking about a 100-day challenge led by the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness and Journey Home of Hartford. We're going to be checking in today with some of the people involved in these initiatives, which ended just last week. We'll find out what progress has been made to cut the number of Connecticut's homeless down to zero. We're also going to meet Sal Pinna in person. Susan Campbell's been profiling Sal over the last few months. After 20 years living on the street, Sal finally has a place to call home, and we're happy to have him in the studio today. We want to hear from you as well. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. First of all, I want to bring in our friend Susan Campbell, who is a journalist and who's been reporting this series for us here at WNPR. She's also been writing about homelessness for the Hartford Current. Susan, it's good to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Lisa Tepper-Bates. She's executive director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you so much, John.
And Matt Morgan is here. He's executive director of Journey Home. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you.
And welcome into our studio for the first time, Sal Pinna. We've been hearing your voice, Sal, because of Susan's reporting for the last couple months, but it's good to meet you in person. Sal, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
Let's first of all go to Lisa and Matt a little bit to get some of the results of this 100-day challenge. Maybe first you can set this up for us. Maybe I'll turn to you, Susan, just to remind our audience what the 100-day challenge was, because as I said at the top, this seems like a somewhat daunting goal, right? We're going to end chronic homelessness in the state by really focusing on it for a couple months. It seems like an almost impossible task, but we really have come a long way. Explain what this is all about.
Okay, and Lisa and Matt can jump in and fix this if I get it wrong, but this was an initiative that actually Lisa introduced from the Rapid Results Institute, where the process is that an organization or a group of people will look at an issue and for 100 days pledge to address that issue, either a portion of that issue, chronic homelessness, or bringing water to a village. It's been used worldwide. And Lisa had the idea that let's try this in Connecticut around homelessness. And yes, it did sound pretty daunting and impossible, but I'm anxious to hear what they have to say about the numbers.
And maybe you can talk about what all went into this, Lisa, because it's one thing to make a goal, and it's another thing to actually mobilize people to try to get at this goal.
Well, that's right. And our colleagues in New Haven were the first to take this on. And what the challenge entails is getting a group of providers, different agencies, together around a challenge they share, and then empowering their frontline workforce to think about how could we work differently? How can we combine our resources and our efforts in new ways? And how can our leadership support us in doing that? So it really puts decision-making a little bit on its head in a very good way. And what we found in New Haven and in Hartford, Fairfield County, and all of eastern Connecticut is that when you enable that frontline workforce to think differently and to revise the system, you can unleash real power. And that's what they've done. And, John, I'm really glad to tell you that 610 formerly homeless households through these different efforts across the state have been housed, and an additional 274 households are right now waiting for the final steps to get into housing. That's 884 households that were homeless before and are now going to be housed in permanent housing, and that's incredible.
My goodness, and that really is quite a number. And Matt Morgan, as I asked you to react to those numbers, I guess the first thing I'll ask is how different is this approach than what we've seen before?
Well, I would say what's really most exciting to me is that I believe during this 100 days, we reached a pace at housing people that we've never been at before. We climbed a mountain we've never climbed before, higher than ever. And that pace is exactly what we needed to get to zero by the end of 2016. If we can continue that kind of momentum through this kind of work, we will get there. I believe we'll get to zero chronically homeless in the state by 2016.
So when we talk about these numbers, 884 households that are either now housed or moving to this, explain, Lisa, what exactly this means. What goes into this when we say someone has been living without a home and now they have a home? Explain a little bit more about what exactly we're talking about here.
Right. Well, we're talking about communities, first of all, identifying everyone who they're working with who's homeless and having a shared understanding of who all these folks are and what their needs are. And then for many of these communities, the chronic homelessness was the focus. And then saying, okay, let's understand who has the most need and let's help them first. And, John, that's not only because that's the right thing to do, is to help folks who need the need, who have that need and help them first, but it also is part of what we need to do in terms of our public systems. We know that people who have been longest homeless or most often homeless and who have disabling conditions are often cycling in and out of our public systems, like hospitals, sometimes our jails. And that is costing us in a way that's very unproductive and is using our tax dollars in the worst possible way, not helping anyone. When you can house people who have been long homeless and have a disability, we do a good thing for them and we do a good thing for our public systems. It's smart policy.
Where's the housing coming from?
So some of the housing we're talking about, a lot of it in fact, is what we call permanent supportive housing. And that's a voucher to support the cost of the housing itself and also case management services to help folks who do have that disabling condition to do what they need to stay stable and healthy and to be as productive as they can be.
I'm wondering if you can talk about specifically some of the results in the greater Hartford region, Matt, where you've been working.
Sure. So we had our goal for our community was to house 100 chronically homeless people in 100 days. And we did not reach that goal. We got 52 chronically homeless housed, and another 46 are matched to a housing slot that's reserved for them, basically, and they're in the process of getting housed. So we expect to meet our goal in the next few weeks. But what's different, I think, what's really bringing about this great change is that, well, not just in Hartford, in all of the communities, I believe most of the communities anyway, they've all moved to one single prioritized list for housing rather than each agency by agency, program by program having separate lists. So now it's like, okay, in our entire community, who is the longest homeless? Who is the person that has the most severe health needs? And where are people staying? Are they unsheltered? Are they sheltered? And then focusing in as a whole community, that person is the next person we're going to house, and we're all going to put our resources forward to make sure that happens.
And this is a system that essentially wasn't in place before. I mean, you weren't all sharing this information. A lot of people working very hard at solving this problem, but not necessarily working together.
That's correct. That's right. But before, a year ago, it was not. It was every program was separate and had its own wait list, and it was a first-come, first-served system. So it just wasn't set up, especially for the people with the most severe mental health disabilities, to be able to access the housing and resources they need. The other thing, though, that's really an important component, I think, that's a change is during this 100 days, we were providing navigation services for people. The people that were moving quickly between all the different shelters and going outside and going to a friend's house for a couple of nights, we were actually having specific people assigned to them to not lose track of them, because so often that's the problem. People lose track. They go missing. You know, the housing provider can't find them. But we had people assigned to follow them all the way through the process until they signed a lease for their own apartment.
We were talking with Matt Morgan from Journey Home and Lisa Tepper Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We're talking about a 100-day challenge to try to end chronic homelessness in the greater Hartford region, but a longer challenge that the entire state has been working on. And as we've been getting numbers this morning, over 800 people actually moving into housing that didn't have it prior. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266 with thoughts and questions about this. Lisa, I know you want to jump in quickly.
That's right. And Matt, everything that you've said, of course, is exactly right. But just to show you what the power of this is, in one of our most important permanent supportive housing programs in New Haven, by working in this coordinated way, they managed to shrink from 2.5 years to 80 days, the amount of time it takes to house someone with these complex needs who is coming in and out of shelters, in and out of hospitals. That's incredible. That's good for that person, for the community, and for those public systems.
I want to bring back in Susan Campbell, because I know that you've been talking with a lot of people who've been helped by this. And as Lisa was talking about the numbers, she talked about households, not necessarily individuals. I know you talked with a couple that was recently recently housed through this 100-day challenge in Greater Hartford. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. Excuse me. I spoke with Jack Jacobs and his girlfriend, Shannon McLaughlin. They had been homeless for years, sometimes separately, but most recently together. Their last address was a tent down on the Connecticut River. They were somewhat hampered because they had a dog, Cookie, whom they did not want to leave. That's a member of their family. But they were recently housed, and they're living now in the Asylum Hill area, and they love it.
And here's a little bit of tape that I think that you got. You talked to them about this. Let's listen.
It's like heaven.
Yeah. Awesome.
Compared to what we've been going through, this is like heaven.
Yeah.
Living outside is not as easy as everybody thinks it is. I mean, you have to make sure that you have everything that you need, especially this winter was cold, so we had to get blankets upon blankets upon blankets, sleeping bags. We also had to find something. There was no way to heat the tent, so we had to get something that would heat it. So we got up at the store. There was a propane, like, what do you call it, burner type thing, where you could cook on it and you use propane gas. But we would also click it on for some heat.
And that's Jack and Shannon talking with Susan Campbell. Susan, the thing I guess I'm reacting to is she says, living outside is not as easy as everyone thinks it is. And my initial thought is, boy, I don't think it's easy at all. It doesn't sound easy to me.
No, they talked about if they could get money together, they would get a motel room, and they would do laundry. And at one point, they did 19 loads of laundry. They washed absolutely everything they owned. But they still had to throw things out. The river would flood. They would have to move up the bank. They would lose things. It doesn't sound easy, even on a good day. That's not easy.
Now, Sal Penn is here, and we're going to be talking more with him in just a moment. But, Sal, before we hear a little bit about your story, I wonder if you have a reaction to that clip we just heard of these two people who are saying, it's like heaven. I have a place to live of my own.
Well, I've actually seen the two of them, and what they say is true. What they said is true. It is like heaven once you get into your own place. And I said that the minute I walked into mine.
Mm. When she says, you know, it's living outside is not as easy as everyone thinks, what's it like to live outside, to live without a roof over your head?
It's not good, believe me. It's not only no good, it's dangerous. You're looking behind your back constantly to see if somebody's going to come up from behind you and attack you. And it's happened to me on a couple of occasions where I kept looking behind me to see if I was going to be attacked.
It's stressful. It sounds very, very stressful, right?
It is. And there was one night, I'll never forget this, I was sitting on a park bench. I was listening to a ball game, and they came up to me and first they walked past me, then they came back and they asked me, are you homeless? And I said, yes. And with that, one of the kids wanted to take a swing at me. And luckily for me, there was a witness. There was a man that was walking his two dogs and he saw it. And he says, leave that poor man alone. He didn't do nothing to you. So they walked away. And that was one of the times I was very fortunate not to get attacked by anybody.
You know, Susan, the things that you and I have talked about as we've been going through this series is that there's an awful lot about the story of homelessness that I think people can relate to. The search for food or work or cover over your head. But it's some of these daily stresses that you've reported on that Sal tells you about that I think are the things people don't understand, that they don't understand exactly what it takes to survive every day, 20 years, not having a place to go home to.
You bring up a good point. It's I cannot imagine the stress of being on the streets, and it's a lot of work just to do the most mundane things, to get from one side of the city to the other, to stand in line only to be told you don't have the proper documentation, to have to try to find documentation when you don't have a fixed address, to find a place to charge your cell phone, to get clean clothes. Getting food, there's opportunities around the state, particularly in Hartford, for, you know, pantries or kitchens. But what about the weekend? So I agree. It is not as easy as it looks if you think it's easy.
And Matt, it sounds to me like like work. It's a full-time job for people who essentially are trying to make their ends meet in whatever way they can.
Oh, absolutely. I think about, you know, going camping and you know, it's great for one night, but not on and on and on and on and on. You just that would be horrible. It would be very, very challenging.
We're talking with Matt Morgan from Journey Home and Lisa Tepper-Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Susan Campbell, who's a journalist who's brought us this series, and also Sal Pinna, he's a longtime Hartford resident who's recently housed during this 100-day challenge. We're going to be talking more with Sal about his story. We're going to be finding out more about conquering the problem of chronic homelessness in the state when we come back from our break. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking with the folks who have been bringing us this story about the 100-day challenge to end chronic homelessness, and we're very pleased to report such success that they've had as we talk about the statewide efforts to combat this problem. We're talking with Susan Campbell, who brought us this story and has been reporting on it for WNPR. Also, Sal Pinna, who she's been reporting on, who she's been working with for years now, and Lisa Tepper-Bates, Executive Director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, Matt Morgan, Executive Director of Journey Home. Susan and Sal, let's talk a little bit about Sal's story. When did you meet Sal?
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe 4 years ago? 4 years ago at the Charter Oak Cultural Center.
I think it was three.
I knew I'd be wrong. All right. Thanks, Sal. And I was teaching a class on journalism, and Sal was at one of the front tables looking angry. You looked mad.
Why were you – were you mad at Susan?
No.
Okay.
Well, you weren't smiling.
It was the first time I had met her, and
– Be nice. He just looked angry, and you,
I looked angry for whatever reason. I don't know.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. He didn't look friendly, and I thought, okay, that one's going to be hard because there were maybe what 10 people.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
But you participated in the class, and oh, yeah. And I've told other people this. He wrote an essay about people who meant something to him, and every paragraph ended, but I don't see him no more, or I don't see her no more. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And then you kept coming to class. You stayed with it.
Yeah, I kept coming. I just kept coming and just – I didn't miss a beat.
He didn't miss a class. He graduated from the Center for
I was the first graduating class of the Bott Center for Creative Learning.
Yeah, very good. And you know, it's interesting. It sounds to me like you had a story you wanted to tell, right? A story that you wanted to get out, and that's the reason you were in this class in the first place.
Yeah.
And they gave away donuts. Don't lie.
It was true.
They did. You know, I have to say, I've taught journalism for a long time. Donuts, they help. You know, if you want to get people to show up to class, getting donuts there helps a lot. Well, okay, so could you start maybe close to the beginning of your story, if you don't mind, Sal? I mean, We have said now a couple times on the air, as we've told your story, that you've been on the street for like 20 years.
Yes.
So why? Why have you been on the street for 20 years?
Well, it happened back when I was living in Long Island. My mother had passed away back in November of 1994. This November, it'll be 21 years. Mm. And about a month later, I had a major argument with my stepfather, and he said to me, "You're the reason why your mother's not here anymore. He said to me, "You're the reason why she got sick. You're the reason why she got worse instead of better." And he said to me, "You're the reason why she's not here anymore." He said to me, "You sent your mother to an early grave."
That's heartbreaking, Sal.
It was, believe me. And he says, "Now, what makes you think that I'm the reason? What makes you think that I'm responsible for my mother not being here anymore?" He said, "You drove her crazy all your life." Mm. And I said to him, "You're full of it." And I said, "You had a mother, didn't you?" Hmm. And I says, "Didn't you and your two brothers drive your mother and father crazy when you were growing up?" He didn't answer me.
Yeah.
And he said to me that on the 1st of January at 95, I don't want to be with you. You're out. You're gone. As far as I'm concerned, you are gone. And he just didn't understand that how it is out there. It is dangerous. And I said to myself, what if I was to end up dead, which I almost did on a couple of occasions while I was out there on Long Island. And it would be on his head, not mine.
And Sal, I don't mean to interrupt you, but Susan, this is, you know, we talk about the reasons why people end up not having a place to call home. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of them. And sometimes it's medical conditions, you know, they can't pay a bill and all of a sudden they lose their apartment and then this happens. But the Sal story is a story that I think we also hear a lot of. And those of us who come from more privileged backgrounds or backgrounds in which, you know, somebody even says, you know, you're 18 or you're 21, get out of the house. There's a lot to fall back on. But there for is. So many people, there's nothing to fall back on. And those of us who have something to fall back on just honestly don't tend to get that.
Sal had an incredibly close relationship with his mother. And when she died, there had been fissures in his relationship with his stepfather before that, my understanding. And there wasn't a safety net. And so Sal, who was dealing with all kinds of challenges, who needed much more support than he got, ended up in Connecticut. And as Matt was describing the system, he ended up in Connecticut with a system that was not set up for him, so that he could easily access services, so that he could easily access housing. And he ended up going shelter to shelter, and for more time than he wants to admit, he slept rough. He was outside. He was on the steps of the state library where he could see the Capitol across the street sleeping outside.
Mm. And you did this for years. And why were you sleeping outside? I mean, was there a chance to go to shelters, or was it easier to stay outside than go to shelters sometimes?
There was chances for me to go into shelters, but some of the people that you meet in there are I wouldn't want to be around, and they had their own personalities. I have mine.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Some of those personalities, they don't mix.
Matt, could you talk about that a little bit? Because I think shelters for homeless people is something that comes up an awful lot when we talk about policy. And our entire conversation during this series of programs, as we talk about the 100-day challenge, is to try to move people out of reliance on shelters into housing. But there's still a need for shelters. Can you just talk about the shelter system that we have right now? Maybe what works about it, what doesn't work so well about it?
Sure. So the reason we have a need for shelter still is because many of the programs that are housing people that are experiencing homelessness, they're not able to do that in one day. So for as much time as – and some can do it. I mean, the fastest I've seen is like within a week. You could get someone who's already ready for a housing program, ready. They already have an apartment identified. Then you can get them in within a week. They still need a place to stay during that week. But for some programs, it actually takes several weeks for the person to get through all of the different inspections and application processes. And so there's a whole time period that some people will need, and they still and shelter is a cost effective solution. That's the reason we have shelters, and as opposed to other, you know, keeping them incarcerated, keeping them in an emergency room that's very, very expensive. So it's a holding place. However, the way that many people are experiencing homelessness is because of the arduous process to get into housing, and because of a lack of housing programs in general, we don't have sufficient resources to get everyone housed quickly and easily. Many people feel like they become trapped in the system, and they move from shelter to shelter. And what I don't like about shelters is the concentration of people with lots of difficult problems they're facing all in one place. I think that can, in some contexts, that can tear people down. In some smaller programs, I think there can be some, you know, story sharing and strengthening up of people in those contexts, depending on how the programming and everything is set up for the shelters.
I know, Susan, you had a conversation recently with the Department of Housing Commissioner about the issue of homeless shelters moving forward.
Yes, Commissioner Klein talked a wide range of topics about housing and homelessness, but she did say, and Lisa can probably address this as well, that the system is changing radically, particularly in the last few years. And while she lauded the work of the providers, the people on the ground, and they do incredible work, their jobs are changing as we focus more on getting people housed.
Let's hear a little bit from that conversation with the commissioner of the Department of Housing, Yvonne Klein.
The whole goal, I mean, a homeless shelter is really, it's not meant to be your semi-permanent place of residence. I mean, your job is, you know, I just see it as to get people housed and out, out onto permanent housing. That's what it is. And we're grateful that we have the shelters that we have, especially after the past two winters that we've had. And I do think we will always need homeless shelters. I don't think as many as we have. We will always have folks who will be at a point of homelessness for a period of time. And that's, I'm not being fatalistic about that. Things happen. But we will know how better to get them on a path or into permanent housing quicker.
Lisa, do you have a thought?
I just wanted to say that further to what Matt was saying, the emergency shelters are critically important and will be for a while. Our shelters across the state are about 100% full, about 100% of the time. But like in a hospital, you need an emergency room, but the objective is not to stay there. The objective is to go through the emergency room as quickly as possible and either get out of there or go on to the level of care that you need. So we have to think about our shelters as that important emergency resource and increasingly as the gateway, right? We want our emergency shelters to be part of that housing continuum to get people out to the housing they need. And I'm glad to say that they are rising to that challenge and understand, just as Commissioner Klein so rightly put it, that this is a time of evolution and their very important role at the front end of this system is changing, and they're taking that on.
As we talk about ending chronic homelessness in the state, you can join us, tweet us at Where We Live. We got a tweet from Dan Schwartz. It says, good to see progress in this area. You wonder what we could accomplish if we did the same thing for chronic unemployment. Is that coming next? There's a lot of different programs, Lisa, that we've been talking about, including Zero 2016, Connecticut, one of four states selected for this. So this is yet another one of these projects, but meant to do some of the same stuff. Can you tell us exactly where we are with this campaign?
Sure, I'd be glad to. This is a nationwide campaign. Over 70 communities and four states are involved. And what we've committed to do is to end the homelessness of veterans in Connecticut by the end of 2015, working in very close coordination with the Department of Veterans Affairs in Connecticut, and to end chronic homelessness, the long-term homelessness of people with severe disabling conditions, by the end of 2016, and picking up the pace of this work and shortening the time it takes to get someone off the streets and housed. That's all part of getting there. And what I'm proud to tell you is that with great support from the governor, from the legislature, from Commissioner Klein at the Department of Housing, Connecticut is actually on track to meet both of those incredible goals. And that is really good news for us all, as providers, and for the state of Connecticut.
I wanted to get a few more numbers here before we get back into some more stories. We're going to get some phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. We also, back in February, had what we call a point-in-time count. Reports and results of that were released back in May. What that is meant to do is essentially get a census of the homeless population. What did we find, Lisa, from that point-in-time count?
We found some pretty remarkable results, John, and we found in particular that homelessness in Connecticut overall was down 10%. We found that unsheltered homelessness, a very important part of homelessness, was down by 30% from our last count of the unsheltered, and that chronic homelessness, which we're talking about so much today, is down by 20%. So these are great results that I think prove that the work being done is advancing us toward that goal.
Did you want to jump in, Susan?
Just to hear the numbers, the fact that we know people who are chronically homeless by name, we know their issues and their challenges in this state. And I've always thought, since I moved to Connecticut 100 years ago, it's a small state, there are smart people, and all these social ills that happen everywhere, we can address them here. And what if Connecticut was the first state to end chronic homelessness.
Yeah. Yeah. And this idea, we are talking about numbers, Matt, but the numbers are thankfully so small that you can literally say these are the people we need to help.
That's right. And as Susan said, it's the by name, the list that's by name that's so critically important. And the other thing that I think is really important is that we're looking at projections for what the whole year, the number would be over time. And CCH and the Partnership for Strong Communities have done a great job trying to calculate those projections as well as like who's in our shelter today. That means like the people who are incarcerated right now and they've been there just for a few days, or the people in an emergency room just for a few days, but they're coming back to homelessness, they're still considered chronically homeless. So it's important to have that full spectrum. And the other thing I think that's really important, the reason I think we made so much progress in this state compared to other states, is because it's so small geographically, we have people coming to meetings from everywhere in the state, and we get that firsthand training and sharing, cross-fertilization of ideas that's so important, and that we can strengthen each other across the state.
I just wanted to add, while Sal was sleeping rough and refusing to go back into a shelter, I used to tell him, Sal, they're talking about you at a meeting by name. They know you. And he'd say, me? And I said, no, they know you. And I couldn't ever say, and they're going to get you housed, because you would ask, remember, when am I going to get housed? Oh, geez, I don't know, but I know it's going to happen, dude. Just hang on. Hmm. And because they knew Sal. They knew him. They would sit at these Wednesday meetings and talk about Sal and other people.
And this isn't the way it used to happen, right? I mean, this is not the way it used to happen at all.
No, John, it used to be the case that every different program would have their waiting list, and one person might be on five waiting lists and somebody else was on no waiting lists. And that system wasn't serving anyone well.
Did it give you a sense of hope, Sal, that people were talking about you and trying to get you a house, or did you kind of feel like, I'll believe it when I see it?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of both?
Kind of both. Yeah. I kept waiting. I says, when is this going to come to an end?
Yeah, he called it his nightmare. I'm sorry.
It was one complete nightmare.
And we're going to talk in the next segment here a little bit about what it's like to have a place to call home now. But as the nightmare drew to an end, I mean, did you feel like there was some movement in the direction? Did you feel like things were actually going to start to change in your life?
I was hoping so.
Yeah.
I knew it was coming gradually, but it came as quick as it came.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to get to a quick phone call here. Stephen is calling from Hartford. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. I don't know if you remember me, but I was in the studio with you and Lisa late last fall.
Yeah.
Talking about the same issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the phone call. What's in your mind?
Well, I've been listening to the show. I do know Matt Morgan real well. And Sal has been a friend of mine for about 5 years now. So I know his story, and it's great to hear some success for him. And I'm just hoping. And then Susan, I'd just like to let you know that we're all going to have to watch Sal to make sure he continues on the right track in the near future, and I think he'll be all set. Matt, it's great to see that Journey Home has had such success with this 100 Days program. I was at one of the original meetings, and then we sort of lost contact. That's probably my fault for not following through. And Lisa, it's good to hear your voice again. I just wanted to call and say hello, see how everybody is doing. I'm really excited that people are getting housed in Hartford.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much, and it's really good to hear from you.
Stephen, I just want to thank you, and thank you for your praise for Journey Home. But I really have to say the credit here goes to all of the agencies that participated in the campaign, especially those housing providers and the emergency shelter providers in our region. They worked endless hours to make this a success.
And that's true across these 100-day initiatives. The number of agencies and the number of frontline staff who have been working on this is incredible. We're talking about over 150 agencies very easily across the state who have been engaged, and a lot of great folks like Stephen. Thank you for your kind words, Stephen. We're working hard to help everyone we can.
If you want to join us in our conversation, 860-275-7266. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue as we talk about solving the problem of chronic homelessness. We're not quite there yet, so what still needs to be done? I will say, however, that we spend an awful lot of time on our program talking about things that don't work in our state, and it's awful nice to spend an hour talking about something that seems to be working. That makes me feel good. Hopefully it makes you feel good here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the state's fiscal year ends in just about a week. We're still waiting for that special session to finish work on a new biennial budget. Our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, trying to figure out where our state budget stands, while states like Florida are vying for Connecticut's jobs and companies. We'll be talking about those stories and much more coming up on The Wheelhouse tomorrow on Where We Live. Today on the program, we're checking in on the 100-Day Challenge to End Chronic Homelessness. The 100-Day Challenge actually ended the other day, and we've been following throughout the course of these few months with Susan Campbell, the journalist who's been following it for us here at WNPR. She's in studio, along with Sal Pinna, a longtime Hartford resident and advocate for the homeless who was recently housed through this challenge in Greater Hartford. She's been profiling Sal, and it's good to meet Sal in person. Lisa Tepper-Bates is here from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Matt Morgan from Journey Home. I want to quickly get to Kelly, who's calling from Danbury. Hi there, Kelly.
Hi. I just wanted to say I love your program, obviously.
Thank you.
And this is so important what you're talking about today. For a number of, probably over a year, I see a gentleman off Exit 2 here near Staples in 84 in Danbury, and he's got the sign, and we put money out at the red light. And the other day I saw him sitting against the wall against the Staples Plaza, and I thought to myself, you know, what, I wanted to not pass him by, but I thought, what do I say to this person or where do I direct them? I mean, how do we approach that as people who are going about our day?
Yeah. Kelly, first of all, it's a really great question, and I really appreciate you asking it because we've talked about this somewhat on the program before, Lisa, but there is always this sense of you come across someone who clearly is in need, and then you go, well, what do I do? Who do I talk to? How do I talk to that person? Well, what do you say to Kelly?
That's right. Well, Kelly, what I would ask is if you have the opportunity to spend a few moments talking with him, to say, you know, have you called 211? And would you do that? Because that really is the gateway to reach the community providers who can be of help. And for some folks, they aren't as comfortable using the phone. I understand that. We've got people who have a variety of different challenges sometimes who are homeless. I have just taken down this information, and I am going to reach out to the providers in your area to ask them to go out and also look for him. But that's the best thing you can do is say, will you call 211 and talk with them about your situation and ask them to connect you to the right people in your community who can help?
I didn't mean to point or anything, but as she was writing down, I knew she was writing down the information so that this person can get help. That's incredible. We'll know that person by name.
And that's, again, it's actually knowing somebody by name. Sal, can you give us any insight into that? I mean, people probably, as you spent time on the streets of Hartford, people would say, well, I've gotten to know Sal, but I know Sal probably doesn't have any place to live. Or maybe they ask you if you had any place to live. I mean, what were those conversations like? Did people come and talk to you? What did you want to hear from people if they came up and talked to you?
Well, some people came up to me and they said, do you have a place, do you have a roof over your head? And I would shake my head no.
Yeah.
And I told them, I'm in a shelter. And that's exactly what I would say to them.
Yeah. What would people say to you that would be helpful to you? What would people say to you that would be unhelpful to you?
They called you names, right?
They called me a couple of dirty names, names I don't want to say over the air.
Yeah.
And I would walk away from them and just shake my head, go like this. It really got to me.
But did some people come up to you and really want to help? I mean, and really say, you know, I want to help you in some way.
Yeah. Some people were helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And Susan, I mean, what else can we know about that? Because I think that, look, you and I are reporters. We're used to going up to people who we don't know and talking to them. And by the way, that's not the easiest thing to do. If you have Susan Campbell's personality, maybe it's easier. But it's not the easiest thing to do. But, I mean, could you give any advice for having that conversation, the one that Kelly called about, the one that Lisa gave some good advice about having that conversation with someone who might actually literally need your help at that moment?
Yeah, I think people worry that, oh, this is going to be a black hole I get sucked into and I'm not equipped to help. But by advising them to call 211 and suggesting that there's a portal through which they can go. And I give my phone number out because what the heck, I'm Susan Campbell and I'll talk to anybody. But I think if people just remember that's a person and that person is in a bad way and they could probably use some kind words, as corny as that sounds, and certainly use a little bit of a boost.
Mm. I know, Lisa, I wanted to talk about one other piece of information here with all the data that we've been throwing around. It was the first homeless youth count carried out in our state. And I know we've been talking mostly about adults. We profiled a couple earlier. that was homeless. But homeless youth is, of course, a very important problem, too. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it is. And I was thinking about this issue as Sal told his story about not having family to fall back on. We have just completed, as you said, John, the first in the nation statewide homeless youth count. And we've probably got around 3,000 very young people under the age of 24 who were homeless in Connecticut and do not have the family supports to fall back on. And when we fail to help those very young, very vulnerable people early, we are, in fact, aiding and abetting a growing problem of homelessness. We know that young people who are homeless are particularly vulnerable to a lot of very, very bad things. They are going to be much more likely to be victimized, abused, attacked. Many of them, we know, are in positions where they are forced to trade sex for food or a place to stay. None of this is right. None of this contributes to helping them become self-sufficient, productive adults. So we've got to do better in terms of both emergency resources for them and also to help with what they need in terms of supports to be on that better life path. So we've got a lot of work to do with regard to homeless youth in Connecticut.
I know one other thing I wanted to talk about, Susan, was Mayor Pedro Segarra in the city of Hartford has talked with you about the city's municipal identification program. This is something that was started some years ago in the city of New Haven. In many ways, it was meant to address some of the issues surrounding undocumented immigrants in that community. But I'm wondering how you feel a municipal ID program might help with some of the work that you folks are doing as well.
I think Matt could probably answer that better, but this is a program that has been approved. They're looking to roll it out in September. There's no definite date, but I'd throw the ball to Matt.
Sure. So one of the things that I think is really great about the municipal ID program is that, well, the city has approached us and said, we want to make sure that we're taking care of identification for people who are experiencing homelessness. And they said they will work with us to develop the kinds of documentation that people who are experiencing homelessness are more likely to be able to obtain, like a medical record and or proof of food stamps. Most of the homeless population is eligible and has food stamps. So those are more easily obtainable than something being mailed to your home, which is the majority of other Connecticut ID. Requires you to have something mailed to you. But if you're sleeping outside, it's very challenging to get that kind of ID. And the other reason I think it's so important is many landlords would accept a municipal ID. So that's a barrier. If a landlord requires an ID and you get into a housing program, but you can't find a landlord, if a municipal ID could go a long way towards helping that person get in.
And I say one of the reports that Susan did for us during the series was really just about Sal's attempt and others' attempt to get an ID. It's an almost impossible task. You don't have identification, so you can't get identification. This at least solves one of the problems, right?
Absolutely. And one of the things we did that I have to mention as part of our 100-day campaign was a document fair where we brought together the DMV, the Social Security Administration, the City of Hartford, Town Clerk, the Connecticut Department of Public Health, lots of other agencies to all be on site in one place. And we invited people that were homeless to come and work to get all of their different identification things that they needed. And some things couldn't be obtained on site. But we were able to start the application processes, and then Journey Home actually would follow up and make sure that we did receive those through the mail. Thankful to our funders of the campaign, we're able to pay for some of the fees that are required to obtain those IDs.
You know, we timed this program, Lisa, to be at the end of this 100-day challenge. So what happens next? This really intensive effort has obviously shown some real fruit here in the greater Hartford area and across the state in the ways that's worked. So what does happen next?
Right. Well, the first step, we're coming together tomorrow, all of the communities who have been engaged in 100-day efforts, in fact, with the governor tomorrow here in Hartford to review what work has been done and what's been accomplished and to share lessons. As Matt said, a really important part of this process is sharing the different really innovative ways communities have come up with to address challenges. And then on that knowledge sharing to say, how do we now take what we've learned over 100 days and build a sustainable system in each community to take advantage of this? What do we need to do? And that's a big effort. But we take this learning and we put it back into the system for a permanent purpose. So that's our next set of challenges.
Sal, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I have to ask you. You know, we heard a little bit of this from the report that Susan did, but you have a house now. You have a place to live, right?
Yes, I do.
What was it like?
Let's put it this way. It was – I knew sooner or later. I knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And when I first walked in there, I said to myself, this nightmare is over.
Yeah.
That's as if it's a dream, don't wake me up.
What's something about having a place to live that really that you love, that is just one of your favorite things about, like, having a place that you can call your own now?
Well, doing what you want to do. What I couldn't do before, I can do it now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got to be a good feeling, right?
It's a very good feeling.
Yeah. And Susan, I know you've been along for a lot of this journey here, and it must make you feel pretty good too. And I know that as we've been reporting on throughout the course of this, there are a lot of sales out there. There are a lot of people who still need some of this help. But this has got to be this has got to feel really good for you too.
You know, what was incredible was watching his tenacity, and he just stayed on it. But also watching all the people involved in getting him housed, who moved heaven and earth. They climbed the mountain they'd never climbed before. I would get texts in the middle of the night from people who were watching Sal, particularly, who were concerned, who wanted to get him housed. Now he's got a house. He's got a place to live. He's got a kitchen that he's going to make lasagna for me soon. He's got a pen pal.
Really?
Yeah.
I had gotten in the mail a card from a lady from Lafayette, Indiana.
Yeah.
And she was in the same boat as I was. She was homeless up until recently. She had gotten her own place, but she wasn't out there as long as I was. And I was shocked. I said, how did this lady get my address?
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I texted Sue, and she said it was her. She did it.
Yeah.
Sue did it.
Yeah. Somebody contacted me on Facebook.
Somebody contacted her, and this lady from Lafayette, Indiana contacted me.
Without asking, Sal's address.
Yeah.
Yes, I did that. That was
and I didn't mind it at all.
And you didn't mind it at all. And now you're connected in this way. You know, we just got a Facebook post from Sarah who says it's a great show this morning. I was an overnight volunteer this past winter at the Overflow Shelter in Torrington. Spent a good amount of time with some great folks. Heard a lot of stories about what it's like to be homeless in Torrington. I'm heartened to hear this morning that this campaign is successful and hope to hear more good news going forward. As we leave our conversation, I'll just ask Lisa and Matt very quickly. I asked you what's happening next. If people want to take part in programs like this in the future, if they want to help or find out more information, where do you go? Where do you send people, Lisa?
They are very welcome to visit cceh.org, and we like to help send volunteers out to the providers who are doing this good work. So we'd be glad to help with that, as I'm sure Journey Home would in Hartford.
I'll just say we're matching groups, people that are part of different organizations, churches, with the people who are moving into their housing. And so if people are interested in helping furnish an apartment, that would be a great way you could help. I'd also say please visit our website, journeyhomect.org. And then lastly, make a contribution to one of the shelter housing agencies in the region or to Journey Home to help us keep problem solving this difficult issue.
Yeah, and I'll say this again as we leave. You know, we do talk an awful lot about some of the issues that are facing the state, and it's good to see some progress being made in something so important. Matt Morgan, Executive Director of Journey Home. Thanks very much, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Lisa Tepper-Bates, Executive Director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, John.
Thanks to Susan Campbell, our friend, the writer, who brought this story to us. And Susan, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to Sal Pinna. It's great to meet you in person, Sal. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, Tucker Ives, our technical producers, Kyone Wolf, our digital editor, Heather Brandon. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. This is Where We Live.